Pasha and five others were killed in the avalanche, falling to their deaths or being buried. They cried out, but Crowley, showing despicable cowardice, refused to help his fallen comrades and remained in the comfort of his sleeping bag while they perished.
Controversy pervades the life of Aleister Crowley. It's in every aspect of his life, from his magical work right through to his views on many diverse subjects. It even surrounds his mountaineering career. In this, my final podcast about the mountaineering life of Aleister Crowley, I'll be talking about his unsuccessful, if not disastrous, attempt on Kanchenjunga. But I'd also be taking some time to examine what I think his mountaineering life tells us about his character, and also to look at Crowley's historical status as a mountaineer. In 1905, Crowley was then aged 30, and was probably at the peak of his mountaineering abilities. He was experienced in climbing all over the world, and had been responsible, along with his colleague Eckenstein, for developing new mountaineering techniques, including the use of crampons on ice and what we would now describe as balance climbing. He had begun his career climbing on the chalk cliffs of Beachy Head, progressed to Wasdale in the Lake District, beyond there to Skye in Scotland, where he'd climbed the Coolins, and beyond that he'd climbed in the Alps, where he'd repeated some of the hardest routes at that time. And then he and Eckenstein had travelled to Mexico, where they had broken many world records for rates of ascent on some of the Mexican volcanoes, some of which reach almost 20,000 feet. Crowley had then turned his attention to the Himalayas and had been part of the unsuccessful expedition on K2, an expedition which had essentially been driven back by bad weather. So by 1905, Crowley felt able to attempt Kanchenjunga. I think it's important to reflect for a moment just what Crowley was taking on when he attempted Kanchenjunga. The mountain, even today, is accepted as one of the hardest challenges in mountaineering. Although Kanchenjunga is not quite as high as Everest, it's considered technically much harder. And the mountain can claim, because of its altitude and the difficulties of its ascent, perhaps to be the most difficult in the world. It must also be remembered that Crowley was climbing at a time when our understanding of Himalayan climbing was in its infancy. He was climbing with very rudimentary equipment and an age when helicopters and rescue teams just didn't exist. They must also remember that it took a further 50 years of development in mountaineering skill and technique before many of the Himalayan giants were actually eventually conquered. So this was an enormous feat. Perhaps one of the greatest challenges in the world at that time. It's perhaps typical of Crowley that whilst many Himalayan expeditions are, or certainly were at that time, months if not years in preparation, Crowley spent only a few weeks putting together his team for this expedition. Crowley's lifelong climbing partner, Oscar Eckenstein, was approached and invited to attend the expedition, but he in fact declined, and there may have been some suggestion that he in fact felt that Crowley's skills were not up to leading such an expedition. Crowley also invited Guy Knowles, who he had threatened with a revolver during the K2 expedition. Perhaps, not surprisingly, Knowles declined. By this stage, also, Crowley was, not welcomed into the British Alpine Club as a result of his reputation, and therefore he found it extremely difficult to find other British climbers who would actually climb with him. Crowley was, however, able to find a European climber, who I'll call Guillaume Monde, I'm not too sure how you pronounce it to be quite honest, who was able to find other Europeans who were willing to take part in the expedition. There was a Swiss, Alexis Pasha, and a Charles Raymond, Pasha was a Swiss army officer who didn't actually have a great deal of climbing experience, but was considered to be an unassuming gentleman and very much aware of his own inexperience in the mountains, but certainly someone who had sufficient character. This is sort of paraphrasing what Crowley himself said. In August, the expedition is set out from Darjeeling to cover the 50 miles or so to the foot of the mountain. It's interesting here that in Crowley's accounts, he talks of how he managed the porters. Managing the porters, I think, in those days, and perhaps still today, can be quite a tricky process. But Crowley seems to have had quite good, I think, skills with these men, as he encouraged them by giving a prize to the first three to arrive at camp every day. And if they managed that three times in a row, they received a further reward. He also talks about having made friends with them and sitting with them round the campfire exchanging songs and stories. Now, I think that's interesting because it shows that Crowley respected these men, and I think far from the kind of patronising attitude that would have been perhaps prevalent towards what the Victorians might have called the natives, Crowley actually seems to have respected them and have a good understanding of how to manage them. Also, I think having been extremely loyal to them. But as is also the case with Crowley, as is ever the case, I suppose, in this man who is full of contradictions. He also talks about inspiring the fear of death in them, and that he was quite likely to strike one of them dead at any moment. So there you are, a warm, compassionate man who cared about the men who worked for him, but was also quite happy to instill fear. That is Aleister Crowley. Soon the expedition was ensconced on the Yalung Glacier, and actually making very good progress. In Crowley's Confessions, he talks about finding the ascent to about 20,000 feet on the mountain actually fairly straightforward, whereas it's clear that his other climbing companions were struggling. Guillaumont had a great deal of difficulty in reaching Camp 3. This is the beginning, I think, of the kind of split between these two men, because whilst Crowley wanted to press on, it's clear that other members of the team became quite fearful and were probably out of their depth in terms of the kind of climbing they were undertaking. Crowley, of course, had previous Himalayan experience, in contrast, I think, to most of the other team. By the time the party arrived at Camp 4, which I think must have been around 20,000 feet, there were growing splits amongst the men, and it's clear that some of the men actually deserted the expedition. Incidents occurred that has led to Crowley having a fairly bizarre reputation amongst the mountaineering world. At some point, a small avalanche was generated by Pasha, who was climbing ahead of the party, and Crowley, who was bringing up the porters up a small steep step that they couldn't climb without his assistance. As the Sherpas began to see their tiny avalanche approaching them, they panicked and in fact began to untie from the rope with the view of running down the mountain. Now, Crowley quite rightly realised that if they went down without his assistance, they would almost certainly go down to the deaths. And he felt, in his own words, he had to stop them. So at this point, he struck several of them with his ice axe. And in his own words, he had to make them more afraid of him than the mountain. Now, actually, that has led to the sort of legend and myth that Crowley actually beat his Sherpas on a fairly regular basis. That obviously, that's not true. And in fact, in doing the actions that he took and taking the actions that he took, he probably saved these men's lives. Following the incident on the route to Camp 5, the party returned to Camp 4. And it's here that one of the most significant incidents occurred that has become part of Crowley's legend and one of the things that led him to be ostracised and vilified by the press. As I've said, the camp high on the shoulder of Kanchenjunga was certainly an exposed place, and it sounds as though many of the men there felt frightened, alone perhaps, and at great risk. And many of them began to want to go down. Here again, there was clearly a split between Crowley and the rest of the party, and he was unable to persuade them to remain. Now, in Crowley's account, he says that he told them that the slope below them was liable to avalanche. Now, it's worth realizing that at that point, the understanding that many mountaineers had of what happens in high altitudes was certainly not as great as it was today. No modern mountaineer would attempt to descend a snow slope after the afternoon sun has been on it for a while. What happens, obviously, is that the sun heats up the snow, and there is a far greater risk of avalanche than there would be earlier in the day. So the logical thing to have done would have been just to have remained where they are, as Crowley tried to persuade them so to do. Pasha, the Swiss army officer for whom Crowley had developed some affection, and Guillaumont and the rest of the party decided to descend, with only a handful of people staying at Camp 4. It's then on their way down that they were hit by a huge avalanche. Pasha and five others were swept to their deaths, either dying in the fall or crushed by the huge lumps of rock and ice that would have been in such an avalanche. And it's here, again, that Crowley's actions are extremely controversial. It's said that the survivors of the avalanche, who were trying to dig out their fallen comrades, if you like, called up to Crowley and asked for assistance, or shouting for assistance, if you like. Crowley heard them, but refused to descend. Crowley's apparent refusal to go down to assist his fallen comrades has been levelled against him as an act of cowardice for many years. But it is the case that he did send down a member of his party to investigate what was happening, and that person didn't return. I think if we examine why Crowley didn't descend, I think there are a number of reasons. Not to help other stricken climbers is perhaps the greatest sin of mountaineering. And it's reported in the papers and the newspapers at the time, certainly led to him being ostracized by many climbers. However, I think there may be a number of reasons that explain this. Firstly, let's consider whether Crowley might have been too afraid to descend. I think that highly unlikely for a number of reasons. Firstly, because Crowley clearly was a courageous individual, climbing in extreme conditions at the most outer edge of anyone's ability. If he was a timid man, he certainly wouldn't be there at all. And there are numerous instances or examples of Crowley's courage throughout, not only his mountaineering career, but his private life and personal life as well. So I don't think that it was fear that stopped him. But I think there may have been two other psychological reasons that made it difficult for him to descend. It's certainly my view that Crowley, throughout his life, found it difficult to cope with the death of those around him. The most traumatic experience and life-changing experience, I suppose, of his entire life was the death of his father, which I think propelled the young Crowley into a very difficult and dark experience living in the rather brutal public schools of the Victorian era. I think going down to face the deaths of his comrades would have been a difficult thing for him. But there also may be some other explanation in Crowley's magical beliefs. Certainly, I think that Crowley felt that he was able to look into the future to some extent, and I think to understand snow conditions and to see what was happening on the mountain in some, I suppose, some supernatural way that others were not. Crowley, I think, would have known that who was dead, or thought that he did, or believed that he did, perhaps. And clearly, there was little that he actually could have done to have helped. I don't think one can criticise him overly for that decision. I think that he was in a very difficult position. And he himself says that although he heard cries, the men were shouting all day anyway. And it's perhaps possible that he was unaware that an avalanche had taken place. Even had he been, the position that it would have been too dangerous for him to descend isn't really one that one can sustain, because once a slope has avalanched, it's highly unlikely to avalanche again. So I think he probably would have known that he could have descended with some degree of safety. Nevertheless, the fact that Crowley didn't descend to assist his men has been held against him for many years, and something that has darkened his reputation as a mountaineer, I think without real justification. The avalanche brought the end of his expedition, and in fact, that was the last serious expedition of any kind that Crowley was to take part in. After the avalanche, he descended the mountain very quickly and set off for India, and never returned to the Himalayas again. When I began climbing, I came across pictures of Aleister Crowley and talked to other climbers about him. He was considered, I have to say, I am afraid, a madman and someone who practiced dark arts. And his achievements, I think, as a mountaineer, have been very much underrated. One of the issues is that Crowley, never a man to get on with the establishment, never a man to be an establishment figure, had upset the British Alpine Club, and they therefore basically ignored his achievements. In my view, however, Crowley undoubtedly was climbing at the forefront of mountaineering at the time. He was attempting the world's highest peaks, and although he has largely been ignored by mountaineering history, my view is that he could lay claim to certainly being amongst the leading, if not the leading, British mountaineer of his generation. That he failed on K2 and Kanchenjunga is no dishonour. He was attempting enormous mountaineering feats at the time, and to fail on those is absolutely no dishonour. In fact, it's certainly the case that the route that Crowley had planned up Kanchenjunga was in fact the route that was followed by the successful expedition in 1955. In many ways, as a mountaineer, Crowley was ahead of his time. Crowley's life is, of course, surrounded by myth, by lies and deceit, I suppose. Crowley himself was not above exaggerating and making things up. And certainly the successive generations of people who have examined his life have certainly made no concessions to reality at the time. But it is the case that in mountaineering, many people find a test. It is a test of courage. It's a test of character. One pits oneself against an enormous foe. I guess you risk your life and those of your friends on any attempt like that. And despite all the truths and half-truths that surround Crowley as a man, I think his ability as a climber, his courage and his sympathy with the men he led show aspects of Crowley's character which many would deny. Here was clearly a courageous man, a man of determination, of skill, a man who understood his fellow men and could lead them in extreme situations. As ever, we find Aleister Crowley full of contradictions. It's certainly the case that his difficulty in leading men in certain times, the decisions he made, the way he made those decisions in his mountaineering life, meant that ultimately some of his attempts were unsuccessful. But it is surely no sin to have failings. For ultimately, in the face of the mountains, we are all weak. Crowley was many things. A magician, a philosopher perhaps. But let's not forget that when he faced the challenge of the mountains, he was one of the greatest climbers of his generation. Well, that concludes my trilogy about the mountaineering life of Aleister Crowley. I hope I've gone some small way to restoring his reputation to where I think it should be amongst climbing circles. If you'd like to read a little more of what I've written about Crowley as a mountaineer, there's a section in the book that I've produced, which is essentially about contains my one-man play about him, and it's called Becoming the Beast, and that's available on Lulu, and I'll put a wee link to that on the website for this podcast. I do hope you have enjoyed listening to the three podcasts that I've produced about Crowley as a mountaineer, and certainly it's been a journey of discovery for me. Thank you for listening, and if you'd like to get in touch, please do so. In the meantime, I hope you can visit my website. I'll put a link to that. That's about the play. I'll be taking the play later on this year to Wales, and also performing at the Lowry Theatre in Manchester. So if you're able to get along to that, that would be great too. Thanks very much. Hope you've enjoyed it. Bye-bye.